For the week of August 26, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 160, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gill.
Well, Michael, were you saddened by the death of Neil Armstrong over the weekend?
Sad, I don't think it's quite the right word. He was in his 90s, wasn't he? Lived a rich, full life, obviously.
Yes, I certainly. The man that was sent to the moon to plant the flag for MTV, I believe, back in 1969.
Oh, God. I always thought that was Scott Glenn.
Oh, you might be right about that. I don't know. But he was 82, I believe, when he passed away this Saturday. First man to ever step foot on the moon. According to some, according to others, it was all a big...
don't do that.
Well, we won't be covering...
One bad joke is enough.
Yes, exactly. We won't be covering space on today's episode, but we will be fulfilling a promise we made on last week's episode. That's how efficient we are. It only took us 1 week. We mentioned that one of our listeners, CJ Flynn of D Cinema Tools, had sent us a lengthy explanation of high frame rates, not to mention many other industry tech subjects. Rather than read all of his informative emails in one go, we thought it best to have him on as a guest to explain it all. Mr. Flynn will be doing just that during Inside Baseball. Before we get to Mr. Flynn, we'll fill you in on who will be distributing DreamWorks Animation's future releases. In television news, we'll discuss the return of Michael J. Fox to television as a series regular in his own primetime show. Late Night TV also had some big news last week with the announcement that ABC will move Jimmy Kimmel's show to 11:35 p.m., which will now put him in competition directly with Jay Leno and David Letterman. What does all this mean for the late shift? And more specifically, we'll discuss this later, but it certainly it means something for the news program Nightline, which has been pushed back an hour. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right. And the number one movie around the world is The Expendables 2 with $30 million worldwide. It's grossed $75 million to date. Been a little slower than Expendables 1 in North America, but it's outpacing it overseas is how it seems to be playing out. And since it's an action film, they can probably hope they'll make up the domestic box office difference around the world. And number two, back in second place, is The Dark Knight Rises. It grossed another $22 million worldwide. It's at $941 million and counting, so $1 billion looks like it is within reach. At number three is The Bourne Legacy. It grossed $19 million. It's at $129 million worldwide and counting. It is slowing down a little bit faster than the studio would hope. They may not have relaunched that franchise. At number four around the world is Brave, the Pixar animated film. It grossed $15 million. It's at $442 million and counting. At number five around the world, another film where the studio is hoping that international will make up for the flop performance domestically, Total Recall. That grossed $15 million worldwide. It's at $135 million and counting. And number six is Paranorman, the animated film, stop-motion animated film, I should say, from the people behind Coraline. It grossed $12 million worldwide. It's at $40 million, and they're crossing their fingers for good legs.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it certainly has gotten great reviews, that film.
You haven't seen it yet, I take?
I have not seen it. I was gone during the press screenings and wasn't around for them, but I've seen about 15, 20 minutes worth of footage, and it looks great, and it's gotten pretty good reviews.
Yeah, I almost went to see it yesterday, the day before. I just didn't have the time, but it is one I'd like to see on the big screen. One I don't want to see on the big screen is Madagascar 3. That grossed $12 million worldwide. That's at $582 million and counting. That, of course, is from DreamWorks, so we'll be talking more about them in just a minute. And number eight is Prometheus, which has opened up in a number of theaters. I think Italy was the big country where it opened up in. It grossed $11 million this weekend. It's now at $342 million and counting. Number nine is Ted, the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie. Another $10 million, and it still has a lot of territories to open up in. And it's at $370 million and counting.
I think that the person who did the poster for Ted should already start working on the poster for Ted 2.
Oh, I'm sure they have. Ice Age Continental Drift is at number 10. That grossed $9 million. It's at $818 million and counting. At number 11, 12, 13, and 14, and 15, we have a bunch of movies all around $7 million. A couple of them are international films you wouldn't normally hear about, but they did so well in their home country, they've broken into the top of the list. At number 11 is The Neighbors. This is a South Korean film. It's a murder mystery based on a webcomic. It's about an apartment complex where a teenage girl goes missing. It grossed $7.5 million in its debut in South Korea. If it had opened in North America, it would have been the number four movie in the country.
The Neighbors is the name of this film.
Right. It grossed more than The Campaign did in the U.S. So that's a very strong opening debut for that film. Right below that are a couple of American films. Premium Rush, of course, had a very weak worldwide debut. It grossed $7 million. The Campaign did another $7 million. It's at $64 million and counting. That's a movie that they probably won't open very strongly overseas because Will Ferrell does not have a strong overseas following, and it's about U.S. politics. So that won't translate.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it'll translate at all.
I mean, funny is funny. If it was a better movie, I think it might work, but it got very poor reviews. It's not doing great. I don't know if that they're going to bother that much. Then there's The Odd Life of Timothy Green, the Disney family film. It grossed $7 million. It's at $27 million and counting. They're hoping for good word of mouth. I think that movie will do very well in Japan. I think that movie is right up the Japanese alley. But certainly one film that is already doing very well in Japan is a Japanese samurai flick. It's based on a manga. It grossed $6.9 million. It is called Rurouni Kenshin Meiji Kenkaku Romentan.
You know, I was waiting for you to try and print the whole time. I'm like, oh, just get to the Japanese film. I want to see how he pronounces it.
But so it's the latest installment in Rurouni Kenshin. It's apparently the name of the samurai, I take it. And this latest edition, this latest tale is called Meiji Kenkaku Romentan.
Yeah, and so, I guess it's a popular manga series.
That's right. Yeah. And at number 16 worldwide, this is the biggest movie news story of the week. It's the Obama documentary called 2016, Obama's America. It opened wide in America, and it grossed $6.1 million this weekend. It's at $9 million worldwide and counting. This is a huge weekend for a documentary film. I mean, there's no arguing. We talked last weekend about how well it did in limited release and how it was big news and how, no, it wasn't even close to, say, a Michael Moore film. But in the context of documentary films, this is a terrific weekend by any standards. It's already one of the highest grossing documentary films in North America of all time. It's in the top 60, I believe, when you count all documentary films. What I found interesting was everybody talking about it said, it's the number one documentary film in America today, except, of course, for nature films.
Right, yeah. Samsara and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, well, that's like saying it's the number one family film, except for animated movies. Or it's the number one action film, except for the one starring Stallone. I mean, it's a silly caveat. It's not the number one documentary film of the year. It's a very successful documentary film. It's doing great. It's grossed $9 million. It doesn't downplay its success to say the number one documentary film of the year is Chimpanzee, a Disney film that just came out on DVD this week. It's a nature documentary. They release one every year on Earth Day. That grossed, I think, $29 million or $39 million. That's a very successful film. And it's really good. It's not great, but it's from the people who did Blue Planet and Planet Earth. It's a good family film, though there are some Bambi-like plot twists. But that is the number one documentary film of the year. I hate all those caveats. You know, it's the number one family film of the week, starring a Latin. You know, like, you know, a record is a record. Obama's America did very, very well. It's got a low per screen average. It's only like 2,000 average per screen, which is not high for a wide release. So I assume it won't have long legs. But it doesn't matter. Grossing $9 million is a big accomplishment. It opened wide. It opened larger than a lot of Hollywood films.
No, it's opening on 1,000 screens. That's a lot of screens for a documentary, and it's a lot of money for a documentary to make in one weekend that doesn't star Justin Bieber or wasn't some big music documentary that is a concert film.
No, that's a lot of money for a concert film. That's why you don't make those distinctions. $9 million would make you one of the 20 top grossing concert films of all time. It is a lot of money for a concert film. It's a tremendous amount of money. The vast majority of concert films never gross $6 million during their entire release, never mind in one weekend. So, in fact, that is a huge amount for a concert film. It's a huge amount for any documentary.
Yeah, but they make $9 million over the course of a long period of time.
No, they don't. Virtually no documentary, almost no concert films have made more than $9 million. Virtually none. There's only like 15 in all of history.
Well, no, what I mean is, earning $6.1 million in one weekend for a documentary is a lot of money for a documentary.
Yes, but you said if it doesn't star Justin Bieber, isn't sort of a concert film. But in fact, that is a lot of money for a concert film. It's a huge amount of money for a concert film.
I guess I'm trying to say is there's nothing there trying to sell this film, this documentary, like a celebrity. but that would make it earn $6 million in one weekend.
Springsteen, the Rolling Stones, The Who, Led Zeppelin, none of them ever grossed $6 million overall in a concert film. NSYNC, the Backstreet Boys, some of the biggest acts in the world have released concert films, and they do not gross $6 million. They're huge.
Bruce Springsteen, I can tell you, never released a concert film.
I thought he released one.
No, U2 did.
U2, and they grossed $9 million, I believe $9 or $10 million, making them one of the 15 top grossing concert films of all time. We've gone over this before. Aren't you listening when I talk?
I'm sorry. What did you say?
Oh, my God. Anyway.
Now, have you seen it?
No, I haven't. It got very poor reviews. I mean, Rotten Tomatoes, almost no credit. I haven't seen a review from, like, the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, from a conservative perspective. But the general reviews have been pretty poor. It's slick, but they all say it's, you know, it does an okay job, I think people say, about sketching out his childhood in his early years. It's fairly balanced. And then it gets nutty in conspiracy theories and that sort of thing. It goes off the deep end. The closer it gets to the present and the dark, mysterious future that America will be destroyed in 4 years if Obama is reelected, which I don't believe, obviously, but they do it pretty heavy-handedly. I mean, they were literally, you know, we're going to give up all our nuclear weapons and be overrun by communists and you name it, you know.
Well, did you see Premium Rush? That was another big release over the weekend, which I guess a lot of, you know, it's disappointing. It didn't do well.
I know. I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I'm looking forward to Looper. This movie looked asinine from the second I saw the first trailer. I thought, Joseph, what are you thinking? If you're trying to make a commercial movie, this is not it. Remaking Quicksilver is not the way to go, even though Kevin Bacon may be your idol. It just got awful reviews. It looks stupid. I actually wanted to see it just because for cheesy purposes. But my friend who I wanted to go with wasn't available, so I ended up not going. It opened very poorly in North America. It opened a little bit overseas, made about $1 million. And in North America, less than Obama, the 2016 Obama's America. So not a successful weekend for that movie at all.
Yeah, I mean, Nikki Fink took it to task on Deadline Hollywood. But and she really went after Gavin Pallone, who was the film's producer. And I guess he has a blog. And in his blog on The Atlantic Monthly, he called her to task and said that publicly called her a nasty person. You know, that he
took a shot at her a month ago and said she's not a nice person. She indulges in, quote, nasty personal attacks, threatening people and exhibiting general incivility. That was a month ago on The Atlantic Monthly. On their website, where he has a blog. And by the way, The Atlantic Monthly has one of the best interactive websites in the business. It's a big part of their business, their web presence. So having a blog there is pretty notable. I'd be pretty proud of that. It's not like he just posted something on Blogger.
That's right. Yeah. Well, when this film tanked, she basically said, well, I guess it sucks to be Pallone these days. Maybe he should make his day job writing that lame blog, which I thought was kind of petty.
Well, and she's just proving his point.
Right. Well, and I guess just to prove how petty she really is, and this is Nikki Fink, or can be, she basically called Jeff Boucher, who we've had on the show a number of times. He's over at the LA Times, or at least was last time we spoke to him, and he writes the Hero Complex blog. And in his Twitter account, he writes, shortest phone call ever. Hi, it's Nikki Fink. I heard you're leaving the Times. I'm not a fan. Click.
So he just said, I'm not a fan, and hung up.
Yeah.
Of course, that was a bit of a shock for us who saw this on Twitter or Facebook.
I think it was a shock to everybody because Patrick Goldstein, who has also been on the show, a longtime columnist at the Times, 12 years, he's been writing the Big Picture column at the LA Times. It's a, you know, widely read column in the industry. He left. He took a buyout and wrote his last column last Wednesday, tried to get him on the show, and he was quote unquote unavailable, according to the Times. I couldn't figure out whether he was unavailable through the Times or whether he was unavailable to us, period. But
they're new. They have new owners. They're cleaning house, obviously.
Well, they're not new owners, but they finally got out of bankruptcy.
Ah, I thought they also had new owners.
No.
Not last year. They didn't have a new people take over.
No, not at all.
Oh, okay. So they're obviously hurting financially. They fired a lot of book people last year, as we reported. We don't know whether Jeff Boucher is gone. I mean, based on what he's posted publicly, it sounds like maybe he is out the door. If you are trying to revamp the LA Times, the very model of the type of reporter you want and should keep is Jeff Boucher. Not to both smoke up his ass, but he's online. He's got a web presence. He does public appearances. He has a huge following on Twitter and here and else. He created something that's very valuable for the company. He's exactly what they want reporters to do. They want you to work 24/7. They want you to write articles for numerous sections and have a blog and have a big web presence and have fans and reach out to the public in various ways. He has a film festival that's an annual event. They're going to be doing The Lord of the Rings, though, this year. I don't know if they will. He is literally what you want your reporters to do. You want them to be very proactive, very social media savvy, and, of course, on top of it all, a good writer and a good reporter. So letting him slip away or kicking him out because you're paying him too much money, I doubt that.
Well, he's been there for 20-some-odd years, 21 years, so, you know, he probably was making a pretty penny, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, look, he deserves it. Look at what he's done.
It boggles the mind that they would let him go, much less that they would fire him. We don't know what the situation is.
No, I mean, I'm sure it's a buyout, you know, where it's the kind of thing where it's, you know, you either take the buyout or we're going to let you go and you won't have any...
Well, that's firing someone.
Yeah.
So we'll let you know when something official is made public. Naturally, I imagine Jeff Boucher could go anywhere. He could be at the New York Times. He could be on Variety or Hollywood Reporter. He could launch his own website. He could be in a studio. He could be a Marvel. Who knows where he might go? There's lots of possibilities. He could be on TV. I've been pushing him in a joking, friendly way that he should be doing the Hero Complex on CNN or MSNBC or somewhere else. They need to fill, you know, day parts. And I think his website is a perfect fit for a 24-hour news channel. So who knows? I think he has a lot of open doors for him. He's too talented to not land on his feet and perhaps even flourish somewhere else. So as soon as we know something official, we'll let you know.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, it was Ann Thompson, also a former guest of the show, that earlier in the week when Patrick Goldstein announced he was not retiring, but leaving the LA Times through his column, she said, you know, the thing is, he was a print guy. And this is Ann Thompson talking about Patrick Goldstein, that he was a print guy who didn't adapt to the new world where you have to constantly reach out and engage your readers, build your fan base, keep the news coming. And she says, the LA Times Jeff Boucher is the new model entertainment writer, constantly creating and repurposing and sending out new material online via his Hero Complex blog. Less than a week later, he's leaving.
Well, somebody else who's leaving is DreamWorks Animation. They're leaving their deal with Paramount and switching their distribution deal to Fox.
Yes, and now there are many reasons for this, really two big reasons. They were looking for a better deal.
What was wrong with their deal before?
Well, Paramount was releasing DreamWorks Animation films on a kind of a service deal. So Paramount would get, you know, 8%, and usually these deals are between 8 and 15%, you know, flat. And I mean these big studio deals. Certainly there are service deals where... and distribution deals where they're, you know, much higher than that.
So you're an independent production company. You make a movie, Paramount releases your film, and they get, say, 10% of the revenue.
That's correct. Now, that is on a high level. That is basically, that is at a studio level. You know, like when Lucas made the prequels for Star Wars, he went to Fox, and I think they got something like 15%.
I thought they got even a worse deal than that. But the point is, they get a cut of the revenue. But my question is, what revenue? Do they get a cut of the money, 15% of what comes back to the studio from distributors?
You mean from exhibitors? Since
it wouldn't be the grosses, obviously. It would be their return from exhibitors.
Yeah, so, I think it depends on the deal. Some are gross, some are net gross, meaning you know, you have to get your money back after taxes, after the exhibitor, the movie theaters take their cut after all expenses, then you can get your 10%.
So that's how distribution works. So they had a deal with Paramount and they wanted a better deal.
That's right. I think that Katzenberg had a bit of a beef with some of the executives over or Paramount itself. I don't think he felt that Paramount supported DreamWorks Animation as well as it could, especially when he was releasing Monsters vs. Aliens. This was a big risk. With lots of 3D, you know, he spent a lot of money on the 3D. He wanted a huge push. He didn't get the push he wanted. Film did okay anyway, but I think that was more because he beat the drum loud enough.
It actually did very poorly overseas. It made less money overseas than it did in North America. Monsters vs. Aliens grossed $200 million in the U.S. and only $180 million overseas. And one reason people are saying they went with Fox is because Fox has a better international distribution system set up. Is that the case?
Well, yes. I mean, Paramount used to have a pretty good international distribution. They were teamed with Universal in what was called UPI, Universal Paramount International. And they basically, at least in Europe, called back everybody and said, okay, everybody in Europe, you're going to be working out of the U.S. releasing films in Europe now. Well, that's probably not such a good idea. We'll see. It'll save them some money, but we'll see if it actually does them well, you know, business-wise. I don't.
So they yanked everybody back and brought them back to the U.S.?
Yes, they did. Some people decided to stay in Europe and are now working for companies like IMAX.
Is the feeling that they don't need to be there in this day and age with, you know, the way they can reach out to people around the world? Or are they simply cutting corners foolishly and it helps to have a good presence overseas?
My opinion, well, I probably shouldn't say my opinion, but that...
Well, that's why you have a show, if not to say your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're going to be releasing a film in territory, be in territory. And I don't mean you don't you have to be in every single country, but you should at least be on the continent.
It behooves you to actually be in Europe and Asia.
Yeah, and they
Africa.
Still may be in Asia. I don't necessarily know whether they pulled back from Asia, but I do know they pulled
It was just Europe?
I think it may have been just Europe. I don't know. I'll double check on that.
But Europe is the I don't know how it adds up with Japan and China now, but Asia may be the number two continent, if we're going to go by continent. Europe is certainly right up there as number three, right?
Yes, it is.
All right.
I mean,
so they wanted a better deal. Did they get it?
They did not. No, Fox is going to be taking 8%. Well, I guess let me rephrase that. They didn't get a better percentage deal, meaning DreamWorks will still pay Fox 8% of revenue from box office and some DVD sales, which is the same amount they were paying Paramount Pictures. However, they will be keeping 2% more on things such as digital distribution and video on demand and downloads. So they got a better deal when it comes to that new kind of digital domain, if you will.
Well, did they have such a poor deal before that they could have expected to do a lot better?
No. I mean, this is exactly the type of, 8% is already low. I don't know where, there are all these analysts in The Hollywood Reporter that were saying, oh, we expected them to get a much better deal than this. This is horrible for them. This is, you know, we're going to have to lower our expectations and our revenue expectations. And I'm thinking, well, where did you expect them to go? They were already at 8%. Which studio was going to take them for 5?
Yeah, and personally, I've never really felt that DreamWorks Animation was that strong or that consistent over the years. They have a couple franchises. They have Kung Fu Panda, they have Madagascar, and they have Shrek, which includes the spinoff Puss in Boots,
That's
which
right.
did well and will have a sequel. But a lot of their other movies, Megamind, B-Movie, Monsters vs. Aliens, they haven't been huge hits. They're just not that good movies. They haven't done great overseas, but the fact is they're also not very good movies. They do have How to Train Your Dragon, and that might have a sequel, and that should have done a lot better overseas. So there is some upside that they probably missed internationally with that one. And I'm sure Katzenberg would say they lost money overseas on Monsters vs. Aliens, that should have done a lot better. But when I look at their track record, I don't think they're not Pixar. Nobody's Pixar, but they just don't have a huge history. And I don't think they're in such a strong position. So I'm not surprised that they wouldn't do that much better.
Yeah. And the reality is they did do better when it comes to, you know, they got to keep all of their domestic television rights and, you know, they even kept some international rights. So in a way they did a little better. And, you know, Katzenberg was upset with Paramount for backing their own animation studio. And so
Now Fox has their own animation as well. I'm sure that was a big complicated part of the deal. When are you releasing the next Ice Age movie?
Right. They have Blue Sky, which is Fox's animation studios. And that was part of the negotiations was, okay, we can do this, but let's negotiate up front that you're not going to be stepping on our toes at DreamWorks Animation with your films and we won't step on yours. So they actually did kind of come up with an agreement for a release pattern and a release strategy. Maybe not exact dates, but they figured out that they would not be dating their movies too close to one another.
So Paramount may have been penny wise and pound foolish by getting rid of their international people presence in Europe. They already were perceived as not being as strong a company internationally as Fox, according to some of the analysts. I don't know if that's true, but that's the perception. So now we see that they've lost a stream of movies that, you know, help keep them in business and keep giving them money. Right below this, if you want to see, it all comes down to profitability. And right below this in our show notes, you'll find a link to a really nifty graphic. It's a movie profitability graphic. It sounds confusing, but basically they've charted a bunch of movies based on how successful they were, how much more they grossed than their budget. And it's just a lot of beautiful colored lines. And if you run your cursor over it, you'll find the name of a movie like Avatar or How to Train Your Dragon or you name it, almost any movie the last 10 years. And you'll see it all along on this chart based on where it falls in profitability. So if you click on it, you can see it made 220% of its budget, or 315%, or 185%, or 47%. And so you have the flops on the far left, the massive hits on the far right, based on how much more than their budget they made. It's a really neat, cool little graphic. It's just a fun thing, but it's a great way to present movie information. And you can fiddle with it and make it present info a different way, and it changes the graphic. So check that out. It's at a website called A Cat Called Frank, who I guess specializes in visually presenting information, and they did a really good job with this one.
Yeah, they're called Infographics, and I'd like to thank Aaron Rich, who's one of our listeners, for sending that in. I had seen it previously a couple weeks back, but he kind of reminded me that we should mention it.
Oh, I didn't know that was from Aaron. I'd forgotten.
Well, TV show that was incredibly profitable, I guess you would say, is what? Family Ties? Now, you might say, well, why am I bringing up a show from the 1980s?
Make it sound like the Dark Ages.
I don't know if it was the Dark Ages, but it was when I was feeling much younger and fit, because I was much younger and fit.
And why are you bringing it up?
Well, because NBC, which is where Family Ties aired, has cut a deal with Michael J. Fox, one of the stars of Family Ties, not to bring back Family Ties, thank goodness, but he is going to be doing a new sitcom for that show. And I guess NBC really went after him and outbid everybody else, all the other networks, to get this new, I guess it's a one camera comedy, one camera sitcom.
I don't know about whether it's one camera or not. Oh, I guess it is. Yeah, they gave it a full season commitment, 22 episodes. It's going to air in the fall of 2013. So we're a year out before that. It's probably the earliest commitment we've had for a TV show ever for a full season. They're making a statement. NBC's in fourth place. They have no hit sitcoms. They're just losing The Office, which we'll get to in a minute. And The Office is their top rated sitcom. It's ranked in the high 80s. I mean, this is a network that is floundering, and they need to make a statement that they're still in business and they're willing to make bold deals. Michael J. Fox has a new regimen, has a new mix of medicines helping him maintain his Parkinson's disease. And with this new mix of medicine, he feels he's ready to be back on television. He's been doing a lot of TV guest spots. He's been on Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Good Wife and Rescue Me.
And I saw him on Scrubs many years ago, so he hasn't disappeared entirely. But as of 2000, when he was on Spin City, he left that show because he had Parkinson's disease, and that's 12 years.
Right, and now it's controlled and maintained, and they're doing a sitcom about a dad raising kids who's dealing with Parkinson's as well as raising a family. So it, you know, obviously fits his life, it fits his personal backstory. He has a huge following on television. He's had two hit sitcoms, which is a pretty rare thing. The beloved fixture, he's had hit movies. People love Michael J. Fox. They love his story. There's going to be a lot of interest to see this, and they're just planting their flag and saying, NBC is still around. We're ready to make big deals. CBS did a similar thing with Bill Cosby. He'd come off his big hit, The Cosby Show, and he was ready to make a new sitcom. And they committed to a full season, sight unseen, and said, you're Bill Cosby. Well, in fact, they committed to two seasons. They committed to 44 episodes in advance before a single frame had been shot of that show. And that's why he came to CBS. That was not a massive hit. It ran for, I think, four seasons. But yeah, it made a name. It told people, yeah, CBS is a player. We're here. We know we have to take radical steps. We're willing to take chances and roll the dice. Come to us. We're ready to talk. And I think NBC has accomplished the same thing with this show. I'm certainly interested to see how it turns out. But frankly, your idea of an update of Family Ties isn't so bad. I don't mean for Michael J. Fox, but flip the show. You've got a conservative dad who's stuck with a liberal kid.
No, oh, that's actually – hold on a second. What was that? Conservative dad. I'm just writing this down. Liberal. Oh, I like it. I like it a lot. As a matter of fact, I've got to go and make a few phone calls. But before I do, you know, I do think a single camera comedy for Fox is a good idea because let's face it. I mean, doing a three camera comedy, that's a traditional sitcom. I don't know. I mean, with Parkinson's, you may not be able to do that. A single camera comedy where it's shot like a movie, I think that could work.
So a three camera in front of a live audience is more exhausting or more difficult than a single camera because you're not dealing with a crowd and performing the show straight through live, essentially, in
exactly,
one night?
Exactly, exactly. With a single camera comedy, you know, you do your shots, you rest in between. With a single camera comedy, you're doing entire scenes as if it were a play.
That's a good point.
But I, in my opinion, the bigger news this past week was as what we talked about at the head of the show, which is Jimmy Kimmel Live is moving to 11:35 at night on ABC. So he will be kind of up against Jay Leno and David Letterman, his hero. David Letterman is Jimmy Kimmel's hero.
And Colbert, the Colbert Report.
And the Colbert Report. And I say Colbert Report and leave off the RT. Do you notice that? I don't know. He's got us doing that now, which is, yeah. Nightline, which is the long-running news show, and as we talked about in our pre-show, is the number one show in its time slot, is going to be pushed back to 12:35. I mean, Nightline is a shadow of its former self, that when Ted Koppel was I guess, the anchor, he was the anchor of Nightline. That's what you would refer to him as, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it had a much wider audience, and so it's definitely pared down over the past year since Ted Koppel has left, but it's still, as you say, Michael, the number one show in its time.
Well, I don't think it's pared down at all. It seemed like it might disappear completely, but in fact, it flourished. Nightline was rarely, if there was a big news day, Nightline might be the number one show. But in those days, there was a lot less competition, and he wasn't beating The Tonight Show unless some huge breaking news event was happening that they were covering. Nightline was a great, bit of counter programming. It was classic counter programming. It did a great job. It's been around for 33 years. Now, with so many more talk shows, it is the number one show in that time slot. Why would you dump the number one show for another series?
Well, let me just provide a couple of answers to that. Now, I'm not defending anybody. I'm just saying here are some of the reasons that this may happen. The first is that Jimmy Kimmel was up for a contract renewal, and I'm sure ABC needed something to give him.
And that sounds exactly like what NBC did when they said, oh my God, we're going to lose Conan. We better give him The Tonight Show and dump the number one host and show in the country and replace it with Conan O'Brien, because we can't have him going somewhere else because he's our number three guy.
Yeah, exactly. So that was
kind of... So they are dumping Nightline for Jimmy Kimmel because they say Nightline has old people watching it. We hate old people because you're morons. And so he may be number one, but he has the sexier, younger demos.
Who's the moron here? The old people or ABC?
The networks. Yeah. The networks, of course.
Yeah.
And they're morons for thinking people who are 52 years old don't buy stuff.
They buy more stuff because all of their kids have moved out. So they have more disposable income in most cases.
Your kids are not moving out, Sperling. Trust me, they'll go to college and they'll come right back again.
Yes.
But anyway, they think Jimmy Kimmel's going to bring younger demos. They think we have to do something. He's growing. He's doing a good job. But it's a terrible decision because it cuts the knees out from under Nightline. Local news to Nightline to Kimmel is a great flow. And it's great counter-programming for The Tonight Show and Letterman and everybody else in that time slot. Jimmy Kimmel gets to come on at 12:05. They've already had their big guests on their own show. So if you've already started watching The Tonight Show, you might switch over to see what Kimmel does.
Right.
Now he's going head to head with them. Now Nightline, it goes local news, Jimmy Kimmel, and after him at 12:35 comes Nightline. That's nobody's going to be watching that. Any of its audience will be long in bed by then.
Right. I mean, if you were interested in international news and you were interested in the news.
Well, it's more of a news magazine. It's more like Dateline in 2020. It changed from the breaking news of the day story that Nightline was. It's now a news magazine. And as a consolation prize, they said, okay, we're going to put Nightline in prime time, which frankly, they should have done a few years ago once they saw how successful it was doing in late night. But they're putting on Friday night, 10 o'clock, a dead zone for television. For everybody but CBS, I should say, which has the hit show Blue Blood starring Tom Selleck. But most networks have abandoned Fridays, just like they've abandoned Saturdays. So they're putting Nightline on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. That's a smart use of the name brand that they have, that they developed over 33 years. They need a news magazine. It's cheap programming. It's good programming. Makes sense. But pushing it back to 12:35 is disastrous.
No, it's like a lot of people have said, it's putting it out to pasture. That if they thought it was dying before, well, now you've basically guaranteed.
It wasn't dying. It was the number one show in its time slot.
But
I guess
what they're trying to say, what I'm trying to say is that, look, you know, way more people were watching all of these shows years ago. So, I would be interested to know, are as many people watching Nightline now?
Of course not. Of course not. Nobody's watching anything the same amount. Nobody's watching The Tonight Show the same amount.
Right.
Nobody. That's beside the point. There's a lot more competition. And with all that competition, it was the number one show in its time slot. You better have a darn good reason to remove the number one show in a time slot and dump
it. Well, what if I could make more money by moving Kimmel up? Now, here's why. Kimmel's demographic, as we know, is much younger. He's on Facebook. He's on Twitter. You know, he went viral.
He's on Facebook?
Yeah.
He's on Facebook? My mother's on Facebook. So what?
Okay, well,
he's on Facebook? He's got a Facebook page?
Oh, my God.
So I'm sure Nightline has a Facebook page as well. Who gives a damn?
Can we say Facebook one more time just for good measure?
That's just ridiculous, though. They love to say, oh, he's on Twitter. Oh, well, no wonder. He's got a huge audience. He has Twitter.
What I'm trying to say is he's popular with the young folks who like to watch viral videos like the one with Matt Damon.
He ain't that He ain't that popular. And wait to see what happens when he goes up against Letterman Leno and Stephen Colbert. Then we'll see how popular he is.
It will definitely be interesting. But what ABC's thinking is, hey, we can probably make more money here because we can get more money for the commercial time if Kimmel were in that time slot instead of Nightline.
I predict his ratings fall. I predict he stumbles, but they kill off Nightline and stick with him. I think it's a big deal because they're being big idiots.
Ah, okay. Well, then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about how Hollywood loves old people.
TV doesn't, but Hollywood does.
Yeah, apparently old people are just cool again in Hollywood. TV is still obsessed with the 18 to 49 demographic, as Michael just mentioned, treating any viewer 50 and older as not just undesirable, but downright toxic. NBC canceled its biggest drama hit in years, Harry's Law, which starred Kathy Bates, by the way. And they did that because its audience was huge, but just too old. Well, the movies are realizing how dumb that kind of thinking is. Studios are angling to make the cover of AARP magazine, which is now considered a big get, by the way. And they are making more and more movies that can appeal directly to the baby boomers. Why, you may ask? Because there are so many of them, and they go to the movies a lot. In the U.S., there are 30 million people between the ages of 18 and 24, but there are 78 million baby boomers, those people born between 1946 and 1964. They're living longer, and they have disposable income, and they love going to the movies. It's not just movies like Hope Springs and Grumpy Old Men, either. It's action films like The Expendables and even The Bourne Legacy, which benefit from, you know, all of these, the 78 million baby boomers. 33% of Bourne Legacy's opening weekend, in fact, was the audience was over 50.
And that was the single biggest demographic for them.
That's right. So is this sudden realization that adults keep going to the movies a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal if they can make it a permanent reality in Hollywood and filter it down to television, that people 52, 55, 62 are open, active people with money to spend, and they're a valuable audience to reach out to. Now, you don't have to make every movie for 17-year-old boys.
Wait, you don't?
No.
Well, then I guess if that's the case, then I'm going to advise the studios that they should release two movies geared toward baby boomers over Christmas week.
Well, yeah, that's not very good programming, of course. You're talking about the fact that on December 28th, which is Christmas week, there are two movies that look like they're reaching out to the same audience. There's Parental Guidance, a new Billy Crystal and Bette Midler movie where they're grandparents who have to babysit.
That's right.
And there's The Guilt Trip with Barbara Streisand and Seth Rogen, which pokes fun at different generations as mom goes on a road trip with her son. Obviously, Barbara Streisand, Billy Crystal, Bette Midler, they're all appealing to people of a certain age. So not very good programming. However, there is good counter programming to both of them, and that's Quentin Tarantino, who's releasing Django Unchained. Now, if a third of their audience is over 50, I'll be really surprised.
Now, let me ask you this, Michael. Are you taking a shower right now?
No, that's raining outside.
Ah,
so
okay.
That's the pitter-patter of rain.
Okay, just checking. Next up, we have Amazon. With a click of the button, Amazon is now becoming a force in launching ebooks in India. The company announced it had gone live with its Kindle store geared to the Indian market, with Kindles available at the retail chain Croma, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Croma, all across the country these stores are selling Kindles. Books are being priced in rupees, and more than 1 million titles are available at launch, including 70 out of the top 100 current bestsellers in India. They've also launched Kindle Direct Publishing in India for a market made up of more than 1 billion consumers. An estimated 125 billion people in India speak English, most of them in the growing middle and upper class. Is the launch of Kindle in India a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? Or should we just move straight on to the next story and call this a big deal?
I'd say it's a big whoop because it was so because it's so inevitable. Of course they're opening in India. It is a big deal overall, but it would be the big deal would have been if they hadn't opened in India. Why wouldn't they be in one of the biggest markets in the world? The point about how many people speak English, I'm assuming they also have books available in other languages, and the ease of that and the ability to offer books in multiple languages is one of the great things about ebooks. You don't have to print up, you know, multiple copies and figure out, well, how many copies do we need in this language and that language and the other language? You can just make them available on ebook, and however many you sell, you sell. You don't have to guesstimate in advance how many of each version you're going to need. So that's a big advantage as well, because there are many dialects in India. So the ease of reaching out to all those people in different languages is one of the great bonuses of the ebook. And it's obviously, they're going to be a big force, and everybody else needs to catch up with Amazon.
You know, we probably should have put this next story right after our first story, because that, you know, our first story was about baby boomers and people over 50. This next story will probably appeal to people under the age of 30. And it's about Taylor Swift. You know, she is one of the most successful acts of the past decade. She's sold 22 million albums and perhaps 50 million song downloads since her debut album in 2006. But it's only with the imminent release of her fourth album, Red, in October, that Swift is finally topping the Billboard Hot 100 charts. Her new single, We Are Never Getting Back Together. I wonder who that's about. Well, it sold 623,000 copies in 1 week, the second highest total of all time. And those are digital downloads, the second highest of all time for digital downloads. More importantly, it placed her at number one on the singles chart, beating out her other songs that stalled at number two. These are songs such as You Belong to Me and Today Was a Fairy Tale. So she went from like falling in love to get the heck out of my house. I guess Heartbreak is more popular than True Love. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for Taylor Swift. She's not a flash in the pan. You know, you've seen her and Carrie Underwood and Miranda Lambert. They're young Turks in the country scene. Album sales are slowing down for Carrie Underwood pretty dramatically. If you now look at her sales, they've gone 7 to 5 to 3. Her last album barely went gold. So we'll have to see if Taylor can keep churning out the album sales the way she has with singles. But she's still a big presence, and she's still a big hit. She was on Ellen DeGeneres all week with Ellen touring with her and, you know, popping up on stage. She's a big fan of Taylor and has had her on her show many times. Some people said it's the best-selling digital download of all time by a woman. Well, I don't like making that distinction. She's got the second best-selling single of all time. That seems like a big enough accomplishment to me that why break it out and say, well, before a girl, she's number one. No, she's the number two. She's right behind Flo Rida in sales. She just missed out beating him and having the top-selling download of all time for 1 week. So congrats to her.
Well, congratulations to Craig Zaden and Neil Merritt. And the Oscars have tapped them to be the producers of next year's Academy Awards. And this is a team with roots in live theater. How to Succeed in Business, for instance. They also TV musicals, Gypsy with Bette Midler, and the Oscar-winning movie musical Chicago. So they really know musical theater, that's for sure. They've got the Hollywood cred and the live TV chops and the old school pizzazz that makes them a smart and actually a really popular choice. Now, who will they name as a host? One thing you can be sure, if there are decent songs, you're definitely going to see some musical numbers. Big deal or big what, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. The Oscars was floundering. This is the second year in a row. They've been sort of, you know, left bereft by the choice of who they're going to have run the show. Zayden and Moran is a very good choice. And if you're wondering who is going to be their host, I think the first thing you do is think about who's in their Rolodex. Who are their friends? Who are the people that they know and they've worked with? Bette Midler, obviously, has been on the Oscars a ton of times.
But not as the host.
Not as the host. She's been a presenter. She's been a nominee. Has she been a winner? Has she won?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so.
She didn't win for The Rose, did she?
I don't think so. She may have won for song. I don't know. I'm going to go back and check.
Well, she probably wouldn't have won for song because I don't think she's written most of the songs that she's been performing. So that goes to the songwriter. But I don't think she's won an Oscar. But she's a Hollywood fixture, and she's gone from being a bawdy outsider to, you know, Hollywood royalty. So she actually has the chops, I think, to be the host. In fact, I almost thought she'd been a host, and I went back and looked at the list because I thought one of those years where they had three or four hosts, I thought she'd been one of them. But no, it turns out like Liza Minnelli's done it, Hugh Jackman, a lot of people have done it in groups or alone. But Bette Midler has never hosted the Oscars. She's kind of a good choice. She might be somebody that they would think about. There are a couple other people they've worked with. They've worked with Daniel Radcliffe, who's one of the biggest movie stars in the world, if you consider Harry Potter at all related to him. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
he's
the star of it, but obviously he went along for the ride. He's probably too lightweight at this stage, too new, but I could see him in 5 or 10 years being the host. If you've seen him on Broadway, he's got a lot of great presence, a lot of charm, and they helped him in that How to Succeed in Business Broadway revival. They had a big success with him, so he's probably somebody to keep in mind down the road. They've worked with Matthew Broderick.
Oh, that would be very interesting. That could be interesting.
Exactly. They did The Music Man on TV with Matthew Broderick. And as soon as I looked at their credits and saw they'd worked with Matthew and knew him and liked him, Wow, that's, he makes a lot of sense. He's a great presence, a great stage presence. He's a beloved fixture. He's got just enough edge to bring that comic chops to it, but without making fun of it. Matthew Broderick, to me, is a really strong possibility. If you think about who they know, who they've worked with, Bette Midler and Matthew Broderick are two very strong possibilities. But I think there's one other choice that they've sort of worked with that makes even more sense.
And who's
that? I think somebody who would be perfect for the Oscars. And people would see it as a little outrageous, a little roll of the dice, a little scary, but I think it would be a sure thing, and that is
Michael, John... I'm busy. I can't do it. I'm just way too busy with the show, and I appreciate that you think I could do it, but I just can't.
Well, if they can't have you, I think they should choose John Waters.
Oh, why didn't I think of that? That's actually a brilliant idea. They've worked with him before, and...
They worked in the Hairspray movie.
That's right.
So the feature film adaptation of his film, Hairspray, they worked on that being a feature film. I don't believe they were involved in the Broadway production, but I'd have to check. They were involved with him. He hosts the Spirit Awards and has shown year after year he's a great host. He's very funny. He's witty. He's sharp. He's on the ball. Some people on the outside might think, oh, he would just make fun of the Oscars. No. You know, like the South Park guys, they hate the Oscars because they think it's self-important and silly and superficial. John Waters loves the Oscars because it's self-important and silly and superficial. His love for the Oscars would just come boring through. He's a director. He'd be the first director to ever host the Oscars. And I think he's really funny and smart.
And get this. Dawn Hudson is now the head of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. She used to be the head of IFP, which put on the Spirit Awards.
Oh, I've forgotten that, I should say. So that makes another connection to John Waters. So if he is the choice, he'd be bold. He'd be unusual. I think he'd be a really smart choice. I think he would do a tremendous job. I think he'd be a great and gracious host with enough little zingers to keep you on your toes. And you heard it here first.
That's true. Yeah, I think I'm going to call John Waters myself right now.
Good idea.
Well, and just for those who are curious, Bette Midler never won an Academy Award. She was nominated in 1980 for The Rose, and she was nominated in 1992 For the Boys was the film then.
And she just had a lot of songs that she performed that were nominated or even won, but she wasn't the songwriter, so she didn't get that credit.
Wind Beneath My Wings comes to mind.
Yes.
NBC's long-running, once critically acclaimed and always low-rated sitcom, The Office, is going out of business. And yes, we are the 1,000th media outlet to make that same play on words. Steve Carell, the comedian, the actor, he left after 7 seasons, but the show unwisely soldiered on. The already modest ratings collapsed in the 8th, and now NBC is trying to create a quote-unquote event out of the 9th season by letting everyone prepare for the finale. The U.S. force behind the show, Greg Daniels, and, you know, he's with King of the Hill, widely known for King of the Hill, he will be back as the showrunner to cap it off. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. The show is ranked number 87 last season. It may be NBC's top-rated sitcom, but it is not a hit by any stretch of the imagination. It's a creative spent force and has been for at least 3 seasons. The show, to be fair, did what I thought was an impossible idea of taking the unique, special, brilliant British version of The Office and turn that into a long-running U.S. series. They did a much better job than I ever imagined. I never would have greenlit this show. It was a critical success. It did have great demos for a while. It was never a big hit, but, you know, all credit to it. But it's just way stayed past its prime time. They should have ended it when Carell said goodbye. So the fact that they're squeezing out one more season, who cares? And the idea of a spinoff, they want to do a spinoff with Dwight called The Farm, in which he's going to have his bed and breakfast and farm. Oh, my God, what a dreadful idea.
He's a beet farmer, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and runs a B&B. And, you know, this is a show that never had the energy to create a spinoff, much less one about Dwight. Dwight is a classic secondary character. Like Kramer. You don't build a show around Kramer. You don't build a show around Dwight.
Well, would you build a show around Frasier?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, if that's a bad idea, if a spinoff of The Office with Dwight is a bad idea, then what about The Killing being picked up by Netflix and DirecTV? Of course, The Killing was a 2-season show. It was a Danish remake, a remake of a Danish series that was on AMC. AMC pulled the plug, a couple months ago. Now, a month later, you have Netflix and DirecTV in talks to revive it.
Together or each independently is trying to revive it?
I think they would be doing it to, I don't know, maybe together. I'm not sure.
Well, DirecTV did work with NBC to keep Friday Night Lights going. Is there a core audience for The Killing? I don't know.
I don't know either.
They opened very strongly. They dropped hard in their second season because of how they handled the show creatively and the murder mystery at the heart of the first season. That was a disaster. They turned off a lot of fans. Have they leveled off with like 2 or 3 million viewers, or do they have enough viewers?
You're asking the wrong guy when it comes to The Killing. I had 14, 15, 16 episodes on TiVo. When they canceled it, I deleted them all. I never watched a single one.
Well, that's telling. And the question is, do they have a core audience that is passionate about the show and wants to follow it anywhere? I don't think so, but maybe they see something different in the numbers. It's certainly not something I would be jumping to enjoy over.
Well, now, Michael, you consider yourself a Republican, correct?
Not anymore. I consider myself an independent. I'm a registered Republican, but I've certainly voted Democrat as much as I voted Republican in my life. Well, and certainly more so in recent years.
The reason I ask is because why do conservative politicians insist on using pop songs? They should realize more artists, by their nature, are more liberal and open-minded. Wouldn't it be smart to, say, check with an act before trying to make their song part of your campaign? Even if you've got a license to play it at rallies, why make a fool of yourself by allowing act after act to publicly and very loudly break with you and your political stances? The latest in this trend is Twisted Sister. When Dee Snider found out vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan was playing We're Not Gonna Take It at rallies, he asked them to stop and release this statement. And this is a quote. I emphatically denounce Paul Ryan's use of my song, We're Not Gonna Take It, as recorded by my band Twisted Sister. New album dropping on Thursday. No, just kidding. There is almost nothing on which I agree with Paul Ryan, except perhaps the use of the P90X. I have no idea what the P90X is.
That's a piece of exercise equipment that he uses to stay in shape. And Jon Stewart was making fun of the fact that the media said, oh, we've got a candidate we can discuss serious issues with now. And then they immediately started talking about the exercise equipment he uses, the P90X.
Okay. All right. Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I like how you frame this. I think it is a big deal. It seems like just another story of somebody using a song and an artist stepping forward and saying, hey, don't use my song. I don't like you. But in fact, it does show a certain level of incompetence. I mean, if you're a Democrat, you'd be an idiot if you played a Charlie Daniels or Lynyrd Skynyrd song at your campaign event. Because you know Charlie Daniels is going to say, hey, Obama, I hate you and you don't love America. Why give him the chance to say that? They'd be fools if they did that. And I think the reverse is true. You're starting to look pretty incompetent if you're running a big political campaign and you don't bother to make sure that artists aren't going to publicly denounce you before you play their songs at your rally. Does that mean you're going to end up playing a lot of Lee Greenwood in Alabama? Well, yes, it does, I'm sorry to say. But I think that's a lot smarter than letting stuff like this keep happening.
I'm still just trying to get over that you just somehow managed to sound exactly like Ross Perot for 5 seconds there.
Did I? All right.
It was pretty good. It was a pretty good, you inhabited that role for 5 seconds.
I wasn't trying.
Well, Michael, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as I mentioned at the head of the show, we're following up on our promise from last week to bring CJ Flynn onto the show to explain what high frame rates are. And, well, you know, he works in entertainment technology. I'm sure he can explain way more than that. CJ Flynn from DCinema Tools, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sperling. Hi, Michael.
Now, CJ, you're a listener of the show. You've sent in several emails, many of which have been too long to read on the show, but you run a company called DCinema Tools. Can you tell us what DCinema Tools is, and I guess tell us what you do in the film industry?
Sure. I'm a hired gun, really. I've just found myself for the last 10, 12 years doing different projects for different people and basically being thrown into areas that, as this science experiment of digital cinema has progressed, they need somebody that can go in and make sure that the customer is happy while all the nightmare is going on around them as we try and make new things work. So for, you know, whether that's meant getting digital subtitles working, or just cinema working at all back in the early Star Wars days. As recently as this weekend in Venice at the Biennale, I just go in and handle problem areas. And really what DCinema Tools is my magazine where I have to go and research problems that I'm being thrown into because I have no clue of what they're going to be. And as I learn, I try and write articles so that I can explain them to other people, because I figure if I don't know, they don't know either.
So in a way, you're working in motion picture exhibition and distribution, but mostly in digital cinema.
That's correct.
Well, now, we've talked a lot about higher frame rates, and you were very passionate about it. And is it safe to say you're excited about the transition from celluloid and digital to the higher frame rate that we're going to have down the road? Do you see it as a way of providing added value, the way color and sound were ultimately seen? Or is the higher frame rate a way of charging a premium price, just like IMAX and 3D have proven?
I think, Michael, in fact, that it's an iterative process. And what we're going to see is that high frame rate might give some of the quality back that is missing from 3D. And, you know, I agree, and I think probably most people in the technology side of the business would agree with you that 3D probably generally isn't ready for prime time. And maybe you could judge from that that it's not really a good tool to use for a broad scope of entertainment. When the high frame rate comes, and it's going to come in two steps, and the first step isn't necessarily going to be the greatest, but when the high frame rate comes, it will allow more light to the eye. And more light to the eye gives more color to the brain and more ability for our entire human visual system to put things together more naturally. It'll be less edgy, so to speak. Digital went through this with audio back in the days when it was transitioning in the 70s and 80s. And there were tons of people, and there still are people, who appreciate analog. But there's just no way of going back to film for several reasons.
Well, one, Kodak is out of business, so that was one reason.
So as you say, we're going in steps. Coming this Christmas is The Hobbit. There and back, right? Again, or is it called An Unexpected Journey, I think is the first part. And that's going to be at 48 frames per second. And as you've told us, there is a higher frame rate that will probably become the standard down the road very quickly that will involve more software updates and, in some cases, actual equipment changes. Is it a mistake to debut films at 48 frames per second when ultimately we're going to want to go to a substantially higher frame rate? Once again, asking theater chains to make multiple changes, shoulder the cost of doing all this. And, you know, is this just another example of studios having an inability to set standards and stick to them? Why go to this interim rate if we know we're going to want to go to something better within a year or 6 months?
Well, I can tell you that first off, the studios didn't set these standards. And it's two different people that are driving this mostly.
Literally two different people, I think.
That's correct. And Peter Jackson and his group in New Zealand, the Park group, looked in the future and they said, well, high frame rate is definitely something that we want. We know that it will give more light to the eye. It will smooth out a lot of the motion and the edge problems of 3D. And how far can we go? If we're going to predict the future that we have to have a movie playing in December of 2012, will it be possible for projector manufacturers and for server manufacturers to be able to get to 48? Will they be able to get to 60? Cameron, of course, has known that he's going to go to 60, and it's going to be in sometime in 13, 14, or whenever it's out there. But The Hobbit, of course, had a release date, and so they said, well, you know, from the people that we've talked to, it's not going to be that difficult to get twice the frame rate and twice the bit rate. I should make sure to point out, it's not just high frame rate, it's high bit rate for the amount of data that's going from the image player to the projector itself. You have to have twice as many bits of color and whatever going to the projector.
So just to kind of explain to our audience, right now, film is shot and projected at 24 frames per second. So a second of film, 24 frames, on a hard drive or in a server's memory is a certain number of megabytes. If you then increase that by 2 to 48 frames per second, you are then increasing the amount of memory needed to display that 1 second of footage and to compress it as well.
Which is a science in itself, and they're actually hoping that the compression science does certain gimmicks that will actually make the 48 to get to, because you'll have twice the bit rate, because that's the way that the servers have been working for, that will actually give them more sensation of color in the different second of time. You don't have to, I don't know how to explain this simply, Sperling. So if you've got a bunch of red going by and you know you can predict red is always going to be there, you will be able to compress it easier. And when there's 48 frames per second, that red is going to stay there more often. So therefore, you can actually get more visual data in twice the number of bits. I hope I didn't step on that too far.
I'm sorry. I'm picking my brain up out of my left ear. Hold on. Just push it back in there.
Well, here's my issue. In the 70s, we had theatrical exhibitors that did a terrible job. Movies had horrible pictures. The prints would get sliced and diced and they'd get dirty and messy. They wouldn't clean the gates. The sound quality was terrible. They had bad speakers, maybe two cheap speakers in the corner. It was a horrible experience going to the cinema for a lot of people in a lot of theaters. George Lucas saw that and stepped in and said, this is wrong. And he created the THX standard to try and force theaters to meet a certain high quality standard of exhibiting motion pictures, including excellent sound and excellent picture. And theaters that could meet those standards on a consistent basis got the THX stamp of approval. And that revolutionized the exhibition business. People really stepped up their game so much that you don't even see the THX standard anymore, because everybody has at their behest great sound systems and great pictures. Nowadays, when you go to movies, you typically see a much better print and a much better image and a much better sound than you would have 20 years ago by a factor of 10 at least. My problem is that we now have all these great new tools. We have digital cinema, we have 3D, we have IMAX, we have all these lenses and equipment and things at our fingertips, but exhibitors are dropping the ball again. They're not taking the lens off when they're switching from 3D to 2D or 2D to 3D. They're not having enough light. They're not making full use of all the tools that are at their hands right now. And I think the problem is going to get even worse when we go up to this higher frame rate per second. It's just adding technical complexity when they're already doing a poor job of presenting movies to the level they should be. We've all been in theaters who are smart and seen a movie that's in 2D projected through a 3D lens and seen how dark it is, gone out to complain and have nobody step in and fix that problem because it's complicated and hard. And they don't even have the employees trained to know how to do this. So my question is there any standard coming along or any way that we can try and raise the game of exhibitors and get them to use these new tools properly and effectively so that going to the movies is as good an experience as it can be?
This is a diversion from the topic of high frame rate, but it's a topic that's really close to my heart because D-Cinema Tools is one part of my life. I've also got a company named D-Cinema Compliance and digital test tools, and we're releasing actually a test tool in the next few weeks that will enable a theater or a chain of theaters to monitor their sound and picture in several different places and ways, and daily be able to see these things that you were talking about. And there's actually other companies that are making tools to make it easier for a projectionist to get in there and look at things without having to use a $15,000 color device.
So it's kind of like THX in a box, if you will.
Well, that's right. And the problem with THX, of course, was that you had to have two engineers come out, and it was really expensive. You had to get a hotel, and then they, you know, it was 10 grand before you finished your inspection. And it was you didn't want to do that more than once or twice a year or once or twice a century. You know, it's very expensive for people. So, and now we're looking at fewer and fewer projectionists because there's a little bit less need, because generally when computers are working and the projectors are working, you don't need as many projectionists. But also, because of the finances that these projectors cost four times what a projector used to cost, they just can't afford as many people. So you need to have something that's going to automate this process. And you're right, Michael, as far as coming up to the standard, the DCI has set the standards, the SMPTE has set the standards, the ISO has set the standards. Of course, none of these people, famously as Stalin said of the Pope, none of these people have a police force. And so it's very difficult to say, well, hey, listen, I'm coming into this room and I know that you're supposed to have 14-foot Lamberts and you've only got six. And what are you going to do about it? Well, who are you going to talk to first that knows what you're talking about? And secondly, they're going to offer you a free ticket to come back. You do that twice and pretty soon you just don't want to go back anymore.
And we should say DCI is the Digital Cinema Initiative, which is made up of all the studios that set the specification for digital cinema. And SMPTE is the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers, which sets the standards for, many things, including, just to get back to high frame rates here. I see, Michael, you had a question about high def TV going from what is, 2K right now, effectively, it's 1080p. To 8K ultra high def.
Well, first I wonder. I assume you're trying to reach out to people like James Cameron and Peter Jackson because you'd love to have them embrace the sort of monitoring system that you're trying to bring to the industry to make sure that the theater showing The Hobbit or The Avatar when it comes out in 2015 or wherever is being shown in theaters that are showing it as good in a way as possible. So I'm sure you'd love to get somebody like them on board to endorse it and stamp it and encourage theaters to use something like that, right?
In fact, I'd love it. But you know what I found is that really every cinema operation that I've talked to sincerely wants to have great picture and great sound. They've paid for it. They've got equipment that can do it. And it's just a matter of having enough understanding and enough ability to find the problems before they become out of hand, before the customer realizes that we've got an issue.
So it's like finding the fly in the soup before the soup gets served to the customer.
Exactly.
Okay.
Hopefully you keep the fly out of the soup in the first place. But as we mentioned, that television is going even more high def. They've set a new standard. These are television sets that'll probably be on the market in 2020. So we're looking at 8 years down the road. They're 8K. Basically, they're, exponentially more, 16 times the current resolution of high def TVs. So, and it will have a refresh rate. I don't know if this is any sort of equivalent, but it will have a refresh rate of 120 frames per second. I don't know if that is in the same technological ballpark as what we're talking about here, the 48 frames and the 60 frames, whether this is an equivalent number in the same measurement. But that's what they describe in press releases about this next generation of televisions. They are coming out 8 years from now, which is about probably when people who bought high def TVs will be ready to replace them. They will have had them for 10 or 12 years and gotten their money's worth. Maybe they'll be ready to make a leap to a much better television, which is much more of a wow experience. I think this is a good thing for theater owners. It forces them to keep up the game and know that, hey, people in their homes get a great experience and you want to be able to match that and surpass that in any way that you can. And I think it's sort of a kick in the rear to say, hey, you can't, rest on your laurels just because you've got a digital cinema now.
I think you're right. And whether 48 frames is going to be enough, I'm sure that if the people at Jackson's camp knew that the equipment manufacturers could respond with 60 the way that they have, and they're all ready now, they're all announcing 60 and the tests are being done at 60, they probably would have done 60 at the time, but they, trying to predict the future like that, that could have ended them up in a worse state if they had shot in 60 and the equipment wasn't ready. So,
well, when you say the equipment wasn't ready, what does that mean? What is needed to go from 24 frames per second, which is the standard today, and it's the standard for a number of reasons, mostly sound and the cost of footage. And so there's a whole, backstory as to why 24 was good enough in the past and why we'd like to move forward at 48 or higher. But what does a theater need to do to actually show high frame rate footage? And what is going to happen when that footage winds up back on a DVD, which will be played back at, 30 frames per second?
Another couple of good questions, one that isn't quite attached to the other. But the first question is to go from 48 to 60 is not going to be as easy as 24 to 48, it seems.
Oh, really? Okay. I would have thought.
Well, you know, you can put five, it seems that going from 250 megabits to 500 megabits has not been that big of an issue.
And 250 megabits per second is the bit rate at which the film is encoded in.
Exactly right.
Okay.
And now some of this, to just kind of use that TV analogy that we're familiar with, if you play a DVD on a high-definition screen these days, you can see the jagged edges, you can see the softened color. It's not easy to look at anymore. Maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, when our eyes weren't so used to looking at high definition, we would forgive the DVD look. But to have played a VCR tape was horrible.
Yeah.
Now I can't look at a DVD on a high def screen. It's just horrible. When our eyes start getting used to these things, we get more capabilities. And this iterative process, I'm not sure, to answer your question about the ultra-high frame rate, the 8K stuff. I've seen it. It's pretty impressive. But for the most part, I watch my TV 2 or 3 yards from my sitting space. This is pretty close. I don't need that much more saturation. I don't need that much more detail. It's not going to make my viewing experience that much better. I say that now, but maybe in 8 years when it's ready, maybe my eyes will be used to and ready for higher definition. They certainly were doing some impressive things at last year's IBC, the broadcast convention, where they could live zoom in on things that were way beyond what normal cameras can zoom in on. And you could get great, great detail in the image that was being displayed on maybe it must have been like a 20-foot screen or something. Incredible detail. Whether I needed it, I don't know. Whether I could use it, I'm not sure. But the trick right now, and the problem for the science right now, is getting enough light to the eyes for 3D. And 3D, by the nature of the tools, both for passive and active, which we've talked about last week, the tools eat light. The filter at the lens eats light. The glasses eat light. The fact of the silver screen that you guys talked about, it's supposed to, because it's a high gain screen, it focuses the light so it doesn't shine on the ceiling and the walls and some things like that, some tricks to make it brighter. But in fact, it's blotchy in ways. And if you're not directly in the center, if you're 23 degrees off center, you're getting a horrible image. Now, I shouldn't say horrible, but you're getting half the light. Again, the whole system eats light. And when the human visual system has less light, to a certain degree, the cones do less work, the rods do more work. To a certain degree, the eyes are very forgiving. You have this latitude in the system. But when things go out of that latitude, if you're sitting off center, or if your glasses are smudgy, or if the bulb isn't bright enough, or if many different things, you end up having a consumer that doesn't like 3D, or that actually gets headaches, or the color is so wrong that it just isn't appealing. And I should mention before we go too long that lasers are coming out to the projectors for insertion into the projectors, and those will change the game another complete cycle. Michael, you were talking about having to invest. These guys are going to invest a lot of money up front, but they'll save money not having to replace bulbs 3 or 4 or 5 times a year. And these are expensive bulbs. These are $2,000-$4,000 bulbs. And these lasers will last for 10 years.
So it's like a laser light bulb in a way.
That's correct. And the final part about it is they don't throw off that much heat. So there's no more air conditioning or real minimal air conditioning. So there's another jump coming in the next year or two that's going to be, A, another investment, B, a long-term savings.
But nonetheless, you don't anticipate that only films going to 3D will be shot at this higher frame rate. You anticipate all films will be shot at this higher frame rate down the road, right?
I'd hate to be the person that actually predicts that all films will eventually be 3D and 60. But
No. I'm saying the higher frame rate. Will Spielberg, shooting a 2D film, use a higher frame rate?
I think eventually he will, yes.
Yes.
Of course, the cameras have to get made for that. A lot of tools for the infrastructure of post-production need to be made for that. But, you know, all of these things are coming in the next few years. But it really adds more to the toolbox. And I think eventually, yes, 60 is going to be the way things will go. And basically, it will happen without too much trauma, because memory gets cheaper and cheaper every year, and the ability of computers and processing gets better every couple of years. So,
well, it's a good thing we have people like you working on it. Certainly we hope that our listeners were able to follow along there. It's very scientific and very detail oriented, I guess might be one way to put it.
I think between you and me, Sperling, we'll get Michael to be a tech geek pretty soon.
I'll leave that one to you, CJ. That's a challenge. You thought 60 frames per second was hard. Certainly, thank you, CJ Flynn from DCinema Tools, for taking the time to talk to us about really what's going on in the world of, I guess it's motion picture exhibition and distribution and the technology behind it today. And I guess you can be found at dcinematools.com, correct?
That's correct, sure.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for the invitation. It was really great.
That was great. Thanks a lot for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Pleasure, Michael.
Well, it was great of CJ to join us. One thing that struck me, he talked about being unable to watch DVDs on his high-def television. I remember switching from VHS to DVDs. And when I went back and tried to look at a VHS tape, I was astonished at how awful it looked. I couldn't believe I'd ever watched a VHS tape. I never did like collecting movies on VHS. I never did it. I always knew it was a poor format. But it was unbelievable. I literally could not watch it. It was just so filled with noise and distortion and ugliness and visual smears. It was just remarkable that I'd ever spent time to watch a film like that.
Think about those of us that actually collected Laserdiscs. Did the big 12-inch, you know, record that you had to flip over in the middle of the movie because there wasn't enough.
Well, I had Laserdiscs, and I remember, you know, it's the same thing. But same thing. It was a big leap forward, and once you'd made that leap, you could not go backwards and ever play. You know, I never played cassettes after I got CDs.
Right.
Basically, they were never touched again. I have not found that yet. I still play DVDs on my Blu-ray player and watch it on my high-def TV. I haven't noticed that jarring disconnect between the two. I guess more and more I'm only getting Blu-rays, so maybe I'm not watching as many, but I still get older films on DVD. I haven't noticed that yet, but I'll be paying attention to it, because when that happens, that'll be pretty interesting.
Well, I mean, it is, you know, what CJ was talking about is all very technical and very scientific, as he mentioned, and if you really want to read up on it more, or you found something confusing, definitely check out dcinematools.com, because he goes into it in depth there, far more so than we could do here on the show.
And where should they go if they want to find out more about Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, they could go to our website, showbizsandbox.com, which is actually where you'll find ways to subscribe to our podcast. We can be subscribed to, you can subscribe to the show on any one of the big podcast aggregators, iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher. I believe we're on the Blueberry Podcast directory. Really, please do subscribe. It does help us out. Rate and review the show on those sites as well, or those aggregators as well. It does help us out. You can also follow us. We're on Twitter and Facebook. Our Twitter username is Showbiz Sandbox. Our Facebook page can be found at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Our website, again, is showbizsandbox.com, and that's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, and also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 888-567-SAND. It's toll-free, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, well, in New York City, but some of his writing can be found on the Huffington Post or on his own website, which is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
And according to my stopwatch, yet again, we've delivered the entertainment news in 90 minutes or more.
Yes, that is true. We tried. We did prep. We cut stories. I don't know what we can do to make it a shorter podcast.